Hi everyone, I'm Sharon and I'm an alcoholic.
Hi Sharon.
And I guess my sobriety date is April 17, 2014, so I'm celebrating 1 year. Finally made it after 3 years of trying. So thanks for asking me to come up and celebrate this month. You know, this YPG has been a major part of my recovery, and the people that I've met here have, you know, helped me along this way. And you know, I remember when I first came into AA, I went to, sometimes they'd get together and they cook before their big anniversary for YPG, and we went to somebody's house and everybody was there and everyone's cooking and having a great time, and it was the first time I ever hung out with a group of people and not one person was getting drunk or smoking pot or using some kind of mind-altering substance, and we had a great time. And so, yeah, I'm glad to be here and really grateful for my sobriety and looking forward to a lifetime of sobriety. And but tonight, you know, for this special occasion, I've asked a great friend to speak on my behalf. And the person that I chose to speak for me today not only has been a good friend, but she's also been an example of great sobriety. When I first met her, she puts her hand out, she answers the phone, she calls back, you know, she's not available at that time. You know, we would meet before meetings and have coffee and just, you know, get to know each other a little bit more. And she's always offering her help. You know, an example, she, you know, hasn't even known me for a long time and helped put my baby shower together, and she's so great with my son. I'm sorry, I'm a little, I like had a cheat sheet here and I'm trying not to use it. but she's always, you know, been there. And the way that I see her also with her sponsees, she has a good relationship with them. She has a good relationship with her sponsor. And, you know, in AA they have a phrase, you know, stick with the winners. And she's definitely one of those people that I would suggest, you know, a newcomer to follow. Well, with that, thank you, Morgan, and I'll go ahead and let her take over. So, thanks again.
This is always like the awkward moment for me, right? Where I have to. Is this gonna fall out? No, no. Hello. Okay. Hi, I'm Morgan. I'm an alcoholic. It's amazing to see Sharon pick up a year. It has been a hard road, you know. It's been tough for all of us, I think, at different points in our sobriety. But it's just awesome to see you pick up a year. And I'll be completely honest. I have no idea what I'm going to say tonight. I was really nervous before I came up here because the past 2 days I have been horrible. Not horrible, but like not super spiritual, kind of irritable, discontent, restless. You know, the truth is it's what happens to us when we don't pray. You know, when we don't take regular inventory. For me it happens when I get hormonal, which is what's happening right now. And so, you know, I don't know what it's going to look like tonight, but what I hope is that, you know, I just, honestly, what I hope is that I say something that helps somebody. And that's what I always pray for before I come up. My sponsor told me when I was really new to pray for honesty and humility, and to pray for whatever I say to help somebody, even if it's just one person. And with that being said, my sobriety date is July 24th, 2005. I've had pretty much the same sponsor my entire sobriety, except for a period of time when I moved. And, you know, I've always been active in groups like this. And I think that's important to say. You know, even when, you know, my personal inventory hasn't been on point, or my prayer and meditation hasn't been on point, my activity in meetings like this has been. And I think, you know, I used to be one of those that's like, it's not about meeting makers making it or whatever, but the truth is, like, it's a combination of all of it, you know? Like, I have to go to meetings. I have to go to meetings to stay sober. I have to do inventories to stay sober. I have to do all of it, you know? I can't just go to meetings. I can't just take the inventory because I need you guys. And so for me lately, you know, it's just been about going through and doing the basics again, you know, and always staying up on my meetings. But I grew up in Polk County. Polk County, whoop whoop. And you know, I just, the only way I can explain like my entire existence before I found alcohol was like uncomfortable. I was an uncomfortable kid. I was an uncomfortable teenager. I always wear things with pockets because I don't know what to do with my hands. Like, that's how I felt all the time, was like, what do I do with these, you know? And so for me, you know, life in general was very awkward. It was very uncomfortable. And I remember my earliest memory, I was like 5, and I remember being on the playground, and I share this a lot because it was very, like, it just sums up how I felt about myself, you know? But I remember playing on the playground. We were playing house. I was the baby again because I was always a foot shorter than everybody. And so I'm the baby again on the playground. And I remember looking at this girl, Ashley, and this girl, Emily, and being like, I wish I was Ashley and Emily, you know? And, like, always feeling that way, always not, like, not okay with me, not okay with where I was at, what I was doing, always wanting to be somebody else, somewhere else, doing something else. And the Big Book talks about it, you know, and that's that restless, irritable, and discontent. You know, and I remember I didn't know what the solution was for that, you know, and I was in parochial school and we prayed and we did all that kind of stuff, and I remember I had one of those helicopter moms. She would, like, we call them helicopter moms in the teaching world because they kind of just hover over the kids, like, and they, like, make sure they don't get in trouble. And so I had one of those moms, you know, and she, like, really had her talons in. And so I really didn't step out a lot in grade school or middle school. You know, I really kind of stuck to getting good grades, being good, not getting in trouble. I wasn't one of those kids who was rebellious. I just wasn't. I was afraid to do the wrong thing. And a lot of it for me from a very early age was I was a people pleaser. I thought, you know, that if you liked me, I'd be okay. And so when I finally drank, I was 15 years old. I was visiting my cousin in Wisconsin. And she looked at me one night and she's like, you want to go to a party? And I was like, sure. And I didn't really want to go, but I didn't want to say no. At this point, like, I'll be completely honest, I had never really been around alcohol. I had never been around any kind of drugs. I was still really sheltered the first couple years of high school. So I went to this party with her, and we get there, and it's out in this cabin that's out in the cut in this place called Hatley. We get out in Hatley, and there's like 60 cars. There's a big log cabin. People are drinking and throwing beer bottles off the roof, and there's music blaring. And I just remember, like in my chest, this anxiety, like, oh my God, what am I gonna do? You know, I've never been into this kind of a party, and so we walk in, and this guy asks me what I want to drink, and I have no idea, He gives me this malt beverage called Hooch, and I drink it. It's terrible, but I don't want to tell him it's terrible. So I drink it really fast, and I look around the room and I see what everybody else is doing, and everybody else keep drinking. You know, they're just pounding them back one after another, and so I don't want to not fit in. So I start pounding them back. And I think it's important for me to say that. Like, I had no idea the first time I drank alcohol what it was going to do for me. None whatsoever. I drank that first time because I didn't want to stick out. I didn't want you to think I didn't know what I was doing. Essentially, I just drank to fit in. But what happened was after, like, 3, and I drank them very fast because I do a lot of things very fast when I'm very nervous, including speaking. So I drank them really fast, and I remember standing up, and it was like know, the truth was, like, it was the closest thing to a spiritual experience I had had up until that point. You know, like, I stood up. I absolutely did not care what you thought about me anymore. I did not care about what was going on over there. I didn't care if you liked me. It wasn't that I felt super confident in myself all of a sudden, but, like, essentially, like, I just did not care anymore. And for me, it's like, I care too much. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm that kind of alcoholic. Like, I care too much about what everybody else is thinking, what everybody else is doing. And so when I finally drank and didn't feel that anymore, it was like, I got to do this all the time. And I remember at that party specifically, this was my thought, if that's how I feel after 3, I'm going to feel fantastic after 12. And I shot for that. And it was the first night I drank, but I blacked out. It was the first night I smoked weed. It was the first night I smoked cigarettes. It was the first night I cheated on a significant other. And it was the first night I ever peed on myself. and that was, like, essentially, like, in a nutshell, like, that is my drinking career. Like, a bunch of series of blacking out, hurting people I cared about, relieving myself in inappropriate places, inappropriate ways, and just a bunch of, like, I was talking to somebody the other day about, like, different, you know, horror stories, and I know, you know, some people want to just get to the solution or whatever, but I find the horror stories hilarious, right? And I love when people talk about their drinking, because I relate to that. When I was new, I couldn't relate to you talking about your spirituality yet. I just couldn't. But what I did relate to was, you know, the women would talk about dating one-armed biker guys without bikes, you know, and, like, stuff that I was like, oh yeah, like, totally. And so for me, you know, I graduated high school with a high GPA. I ended up going to Florida State because it was the number 2 party school in Playboy magazine. The only reason I went to Florida State wasn't for their academics. And within 3 days of being in Florida State, I found people that drank like I drank. And I started drinking really hard at Florida State. And because my parents weren't there, it's like the chains are off. And I was off to the races. And my transcript shows my progression of alcoholism very clearly, neatly organized. And so I remember just, like, drinking and partying on the weekends when I first got there, and then I've never really told this story before, but I remember meeting this girl in my physics class one day, and her name was Jana, and she was from Montana, and she showed up to physics class wearing a plastic garbage bag, and I was like, this girl, yes, absolutely, this is perfect. And so I met her, and I was like, what are you doing? And she's like, I'm going to the keg stand Olympics. And I was like, oh, my goodness. I need to be a part of that. And so she handed me a garbage bag. I proceeded to put a garbage bag on and left physics class. And the next time I returned to physics class was after a blackout drunk night. I don't think I've ever told this story from the podium. But it was after a blackout drunk night. I woke up under a coffee table, which is never a good sign. I still had my clothes on from the night before, including shoes, and I had a physics test that morning. And I pounded on my friend's door, and I was like, oh my God, take me to the physics auditorium, I'm going to be late for my exam. And he's like laughing, and he's like, okay, whatever. He puts me in the car, takes me to physics, and I get out, and it's like an auditorium of like 150 people, right? And I walk in, and I sit down next to my friend, the girl with the plastic garbage bag, and she's like, dude. And I'm like, what? And she's like, you have penises drawn all over your body. And I had penises drawn all over my body from the night before, because those are the kind of friends I hang with, right? And nobody wanted to tell me. So that was one moment of, like, clarity as I'm in the bathroom scrubbing permanent marker off of my face, because there's definitely one right here. And you know, like those moments that happen when you're drinking, and I had a lot of, I got to tell you, it was probably once a week I had a moment like that where I was like, what am I doing? You know, like, what am I doing? And And some of them are funny, and some of them are really scary. You know, like waking up not knowing where I am, butt naked. Like no idea what just happened last night. And I think what's crazy about alcoholism, right, is we do this stuff and we feel bad about it and we keep drinking because we feel bad about it, and it's just like this terrible cycle. And for me, you know, my drinking was never controlled. And my sponsor says this, and I relate so much to her, like, it never occurred to me to control my drinking. You know, like people talk about failed attempts at controlling their drinking. Like, I never wanted to control my drinking. Like, I drank for oblivion every time. Like, if I didn't black out, it wasn't a good night. You know, and it's incredible I'm still alive. Because, I mean, I don't remember driving. I remember waking up the next morning and thinking, oh my God, how did I get home? And I was sitting on the couch watching the news, and I'll never forget this. There was a girl at Florida State that was killed, hit and run, pedestrian. And I remember sitting watching the television and being like, oh my God, I killed her. You know, like in my heart thinking, oh my God, I killed this girl. And like, and I didn't, thank God. But like that's how my drinking is. Like I don't remember driving home. The truth is I could have and I wouldn't have known. And those are the moments that like I remember just sitting there and being like, this isn't right. Like this is not how I'm supposed to live. And I grew up with parents that instilled great morals and values in me, and what happened for me, and it's how much time do I have? I didn't bring any kind of time telling device. Another 35 minutes. Okay, cool. What? 25, not 35. Okay, good. So, anyways, I, as my drinking got worse, and I think this happens with a lot of us, you know, but as my drinking got worse, the people I hung out with had to get worse. Because, you know, if people started questioning, like, where were you last night? Are you okay? Like, what happened? Like, if they started questioning my drinking, I didn't hang out with them much longer. And so as I got worse, the group I hung out with got worse, and I started dating this guy, and he, you know, I pretty much only drank. You know, I did smoke some weed and dabbled here and there with other things, but, like, the only thing consistent for me was, like, drinking very hardcore. And I started dating this guy who was selling drugs, and he ended up having some scary guys follow him around, and basically what happened for me was I broke up with him, but somehow in all my drunken stupor and paranoia, and I think what's important to note is, like, at some point, like, it kind of stopped working for me. Like, I would drink, and I would still have those thoughts, you know, those, like, menacing thoughts. And so I'm drinking, and now I'm paranoid that people are following me, but nobody's following me, okay? I'm just paranoid. And so I just keep drinking, and then finally I'm like, maybe it's the drinking that's making me crazy. And not knowing anything about detox, not knowing anything about alcohol withdrawals or delirium tremens or any of that, I decide to stop drinking. And at the same time, I started seeing this newer guy, and he was kind of normal, he couldn't have been normal. He was attracted to me, but he was like the most normal guy I had dated in years. And he looked at me one morning, and he's like, you know, my sister is bipolar, and I'm pretty sure you're schizophrenic. And I looked at him for like 2 seconds, and I was like, you're right. You are absolutely right. Like, that is what is wrong with me. You know, because here's where my head went, right? In like 5 minutes, is I've had all these negative thoughts going on, all this negative self-talk. My parents have probably known my entire life and haven't told me that I'm schizophrenic, right? Because it's always a conspiracy. And then on top of that, I'm like, well, all of Florida State is a school for psychiatrists, and I'm the study. Like, I'm the subject of their study, right? So now the whole school's watching me. And, like, it just got dark really fast. And You know, I can laugh. I can absolutely laugh about it today, but I got to tell you, at the time, it was terrifying. Absolutely terrifying. It was very real for me. There was, at one point, there was a cockroach on my bedroom wall, and I remembered thinking, there's a camera in that cockroach, right? Like, that would have to be a tiny camera. And just insanity, just absolute insanity. And, you know, somebody, and it's, you know, I really, God, this is the one thing I wish I knew. I wish I knew who called my parents that day. Because somebody called my parents and was like, there's something really wrong with Morgan. And my parents were supposed to be on, like, a anniversary trip, and they rerouted and came straight to Tallahassee, and they finally got in my bedroom. And at this time, like, I had a really weird thing of, like, buying exotic pets in blackouts or in, like, brownouts. And so I had, like, three terrariums in my room. I had an albino corn snake over here. I had a Pac-Man frog in this corner. And then I had two emperor scorpions under a black light in the back. And I don't know why. I thought they were cool. I think I thought they would bring me attention. I don't know why I bought them, to be completely honest. I was blacked out. But like, the Pac-Man frog had been dead for, like, probably 2.5 weeks. Because I couldn't feed it once a week. The only reason the snake survived is he was, like, way more resilient. And I'm pretty sure, like, scorpions can't die. And, but, like, the frog had been dead in my room for 2.5 weeks. And, it smelled like death. I don't know if you've ever smelled a rotting animal. It's terrible. And I had no idea. Like, that's how out of touch I was. And, my parents walk in and they're just like, oh my God, you know, I'm living in filth. I'm like 95 pounds soaking wet because I'm not eating because I think my roommates are poisoning my food now. You know, just absolute insanity. And this is just drinking. Like, every time I tell this part of my story, they're like, you smoked crack, right? I'm like, no, I just drank. I just drank. And, I don't know. What ended up happening was my parents were going to take me to a hotel and just talk to me. And after about 5 minutes in the car, they started driving me back to Lakeland. And they made it about 3 hours, and they pulled over in Crystal River. And my brother was 17 at the time. He's my younger brother. And they called my brother to come get me because they just couldn't hear it anymore. And because what I started doing on the way home from Tallahassee back to Lakeland was I started to tell my parents everything I had been doing the past, like, four and a half, 5 years. Like, everything. Like, basically an open inventory with my parents. Which is awful. Like, my mom knew I wasn't a virgin, but, like, good Lord. Like, she was like, stop. Like, I remember I was driving, and she would look back at me, and she'd be like, not him, you know, and she would just keep driving, and it was just like, it was so bad. And I look back at it now, and I'm like, God, my parents are just saints. And, my brother comes and gets me. I get in the car, or in the truck, his truck. And I start to talk like I was with my parents, and he looks at me and he goes, no. He goes, I'm not going to hear it. He shoved Coldplay Fix You into the CD player, and he drove me straight to Lakeland Regional Hospital. And I get to Lakeland Regional Hospital, and they're like, you know, do you want to kill yourself? And I was like, yeah, totally, and because I didn't feel any better, and I hated my life, and I hated everything about it, and I did want to die. I didn't have any plan to do it, but, like, do I want to kill myself? Yeah, for sure. I just wish I had the guts. And, you know, I signed myself in, I guess. I don't really remember much of this, but apparently as I'm signing myself in, they're like, you know, what do you think is your problem? I'm like, well, I'm schizophrenic, and I'm pretty sure I have AIDS. And they're like, oh my God. And my mom is like ghost white at this point. Because when you say AIDS in a hospital, guess what happens? Guess what happens? They make you make a list of all your sexual partners right there. And they put it in a database. So I'm making this list that my mom's already had to hear 3 hours ago, you know. God bless my mom. And, you know, I'm in the hospital for 10 days. And, you know, they're not quite sure if I am schizophrenic or not, because I really looked that way at the end. And that's just how my alcoholism looked at the end. It looks different for everybody, you know, and some people do have grave emotional mental disorders, and there's help for that, you know, but, like, for me, I remember pacing the hallways at the, because they keep all of the addicts, the alcoholics, and the mental health patients together in one unit, and I remember I was like walking, Glenn, I was walking around the mental health unit, right, and I'm trying, like, this is how crazy I am, I'm walking around the mental health unit trying to act like I got my shit together, right, thank you, and I'm walking around, like, trying to look, like, put together, you know, meanwhile, I'm not allowed to have shoelaces or shave my legs, like, there's a problem, and what ended up happening, actually, was we had rec time, and this girl, who really was a mental health patient, beat the crap out of me with a ping pong paddle, is what happened, and she turned it sideways and started doing one of these on the back of my head, and, you know, looking back, though, I gotta be honest, I don't know if anything else would have snapped me out of it, you know, I mean, I'm being completely honest. When she started wailing me over the back of the head, I'm like, I am not this crazy. Wow. You know, it was like this, like, oh, I don't belong here at all. And, you know, I broke. The act of, like, I'm okay in the mental health unit broke. And I started crying. I remember I got honest with a therapist for the first time. They still weren't sure I wasn't schizophrenic, so they released me into this IOP on the contingency that if I wasn't better after 7 weeks, I'd have to be readmitted for a psych evaluation. And so I went to this outpatient. They required us to go to AA or NA. You will never hear me talk bad about the other fellowship. I went to both in the beginning. I had a woman from NA who called me every single day for my first 90 days. And had she not called me every day, I don't know if I would have stayed. And I found my home in AA, but that's just because I related more here. The people in NA were just as helpful to me. And, you know, I remember I met this girl who was close to my age. Her name was Bethany. And she was the only person who was really close to my age at that time that I knew of in that area, and she was dating the only other young person. So it was like a little, you know, awkward threesome, and we'd go to meetings, and she introduced me to this group of women that had, like, I mean, I remember I rode in a van one time, and, like, cumulatively, they had, like, 200 years in this van, right? And one of the women, her name was Mary Lyons, and she had, you know, at the time, she had, like, 52 years or something. And actually, I think she had, like, 40-something back then. I don't know. Anyway, I started telling them my sob story about why I drank, and she just looked back at me, and she had oxygen. She straightened out her oxygen, and she's like, I just think you should listen for a while and not talk. And I was, like, so offended. And the woman who, I met another woman, and I walked in the meeting, and she goes, oh, my God. She's like, what are you, 12? And I was really offended, and I was like, I'm 19. And and she was like, yeah, sure, whatever, sit down. And that woman became my sponsor. She's been my sponsor for the better part of my sobriety. You know, I think what I want to touch on the most is, and Stan touched on it a lot, you know, is just because we get sober, that doesn't mean that life doesn't happen. You know, and I think I had this delusion when I got sober that, like, I get sober, I help others, my life gets good because it's supposed to. You know, this, like, whole idea that, like, we're supposed to get something. You know, from, and, like, basically the only thing that AA promises me is that if I work these steps and I do this work, that, like, I'll have a solution for my drink problem. You know, I'm not going to drink. It doesn't promise me the picket fence, you know, 2.5 kids and all this stuff, you know, that a lot of us do get as a result of coming here, you know, but, like, I don't know, for me, it's funny, some of my lowest points have been in sobriety. If I'm being completely honest, like, you know, there's a lot of people who say, you know, my best day drinking isn't as good as my, I had some really good days drinking, you know, and I had some really low spots in sobriety. And I think, you know, if anything, the only thing I can stress is, like, had I not been active in Alcoholics Anonymous, you might have a different speaker, you know? And, like, for me, it's always been, like, even if I don't want to go to a meeting, I go to a meeting. And, you know, I got 10 minutes. Okay. I about a year sober, I moved out here. I met a lot of cool people. I met Stan. I met, who else is here? Dave. Todd's not here. Bill. Lloyd. I met a bunch of different people. And, it got really good. You know, I met a bunch of young people. I started sponsoring girls. Like, sobriety kind of changed for me because I had never really sponsored. When you live in an area where, like, you're the baby, like, you don't get the sponsor. Like, nobody wanted what I had in Lakeland. And they were like, okay, sit down, you know, don't talk. And so when I moved out here, I actually had the opportunity to sponsor people, and that changed my sobriety for sure. I don't think I've ever gone a period of time without sponsoring somebody since I moved out to Tampa. And it's been huge for me because even when I'm failing in the other areas of my personal recovery, you know, like, I'm not, say I slack on my meetings or I'm not doing my personal inventory or praying enough, like, what ends up happening is one of my girls ends up coming to talk to me. I tell her something like, oh, you should probably pray about that. And then I realize I'm not praying, you know? And it's funny. I've my sponsorship style has changed and evolved, and my sponsor has changed and evolved. My sponsor, when I first met her, like, I felt like if I looked at her wrong, she'd probably punch me in the face. And then she is not like that at all. Like, she's super soft, she's super kind, and she has been through some of the toughest stuff with me in sobriety. And, you know, for me, I went through a period of time around 2.5, 3 years sober where, like, I thought I was doing the deal in Alcoholics Anonymous, you know? I was sponsoring lots of girls, I was real active in service work, but there was no humility. You know, there was no real sense of, like, unity, you know? If you weren't doing it the way I did it, you weren't doing it right. And the truth is, what I found, and this is my truth and my experience in Alcoholics Anonymous, is people do it different. You know, everybody does it different. What works for you might not work for me. What works for me might not work for you. You know, and all I have to offer is my experience. And if that's not what you need, then there's somebody who does have what you need in Alcoholics Anonymous. And I moved to Delray after a couple of years in Tampa. I actually got engaged for the first time. I got engaged, and I was with this person for a while, and they were in AA as well. And what happened was that completely fell apart 80 days before the wedding. It was awful. It was like it tested my faith in people. It tested my faith in God. It tested a lot of things for me. And I came here. After I left that relationship, and somebody asked me to read Dr. Bob's last message, and I cried profusely as I read it. And I got raw, you know, I got raw again, you know, and that's what happens for me is, like, you know, I find that things get really good and life will happen or something will happen or another layer will peel off. And I have this opportunity to be honest with you guys about where I'm at. So that happened then, and at that point in my life, you know what's funny is I didn't even think about drinking, and there was a lot involved with that. I mean, it was a very public, very ugly breakup, and you know, I remember thinking, like, I would like to crawl in a hole, but I can't do that. But, like, drinking never ever crossed my mind, and I came right back here. I had a couple great girls ask me to sponsor them, which saved me in more ways than one. And I threw myself back into sponsoring girls. And, you know, a lot's happened in the past, you know, 2 years, 2.5 years since I moved back. I met a bunch of amazing new friends that I never thought I would meet or make. I have all these great girls that I work with and great, you know, relationships with people. And I got engaged for the second time. This one worked out. And he's an amazing guy. He's way nicer than I am. He knows you know, I say this and people take it the total wrong way, but, like, he knows how to handle me. And I hate to say this because sometimes, like, I'm a lot. Like, I'm a lot to handle sometimes. I can be very emotional. And he has a way of, like, I basically just, like, whirl and he just lets me. And then he's like, are you okay? You know? And then, but, like, I found that. And, you know, for me, it's becoming more and more about just really trying to be a better version of myself on a daily basis. And a lot of days I fall short. But a lot of days I really wake up and like who I am. You know, and I think that's huge. You know, and like I can remember like not that long ago in sobriety just being like, I don't really like who I am again. You know, and that happens. Like I think what happens for me is I'm not aware of my defects until it's like I'm in the thick of it. You know, like I am in it. I'm like, oh my God, what am I doing? I'm acting like I'm drunk. And then I change. And, you know, for me, like I've always, and my sponsors always stress for me to pray to stay teachable. You know, because I think it's easy to get some time around here and think that you know stuff. And the reality is I only know as much as I've experienced. And there's a lot I haven't experienced still. And for me, it's been a really incredible ride. Like, I have definitely gone through some things in my sobriety that, like, I never would have thought were going to come my way. You know, they've all been okay. They haven't all been great. But for me, it's really been about, like, what I do with it. You know, and I think that's kind of like truly tests, you know, where you're at with your sobriety and your higher power. You know, is stuff's going to happen in your life. Things are not going to go your way. And like, how are you going to deal with it? And for me, it's been a lot of acceptance. And people hate that word. People don't like it, whatever. But like, the reality is I absolutely cannot control you or what you do. I can't control anybody but myself, and I can hardly control myself sometimes. And so for me, you know, it's really about like finding peace with letting people be the way they are, you know, and not feeling the need to control. I'm a control freak by nature, absolute control freak. And so like I have to actively work against that, you know, and I have to pray for God's help with that. And for me, I've found this absolutely awesome God. And we all find, you know, a God of our own understanding or whatever, but, like, I like my God. You know, my God doesn't create this stuff in my world that's terrible. You know, like the stuff that happens in my life, you know, and some people are like, oh, God's trying to teach you something. I don't know if I buy it. I don't like to think that God, like, made this person hurt me and ended our relationship, you know, whatever. I think God gives me what I need to meet those situations. You know, I think life happens. I think people make bad choices. And I think that ultimately, like, if we just keep helping each other and helping God's kids, you know, like, it's all good. You know, and I do believe in the law of attraction. Like, what I put out in the universe, I do get back. And sometimes, you know what, I put out a lot of good and I don't get good back, and that's okay, too. You know, it's not about necessarily what we get in return, but, like, what I've found in this, you know, I'll end with this is, at my very first meeting, this woman turned around and she said to me, because I was crying. I cried through my first 90 days. Like, every meeting I cried. And this woman turned around and she goes, you never have to feel the way you're feeling ever again if you just stay and do the work. And she told this story at the end of her talk. And I'll end with this, but, you know, there's a little boy and he's looking at some puppies through a glass at a pet store, right? And Mary used to tell this story all the time, and I love it. But he's looking at the puppies through the glass, and the pet store owner comes out, and the little boy, you know, he can tell he doesn't have a lot of money by his clothes, and he goes, you know what? I bet you would really like one of those dogs. And he goes, oh, yes, but I can't afford it. And the guy goes, you know, I'll give you one. Which one do you want? And the little boy goes, I want that one. And the guy goes, I don't know if you want that one. You know, he was born with his leg that doesn't work, and he won't be able to run and play with you. You know, he won't be able to do what you want to do. And And the little boy goes, no, that's the one I want. He was like, no, I really think you should take that one. And the little boy, you know, lifts up his pant leg, and he's got a brace on his leg. And the little boy goes, no, I want that dog, you know, because we understand each other. And I feel like that's what happens in AA all the time. Like, every meeting I go to, it doesn't matter where I go, I walk in, we talk, I relate to you, you relate to me, right? And this amazing thing happens where we feel like we know each other instantly. And, man, I don't know what normal people do. I really don't. I have no idea how normal people deal with life without what we have. Like, we have this incredible network of support and this incredible, like, I can move absolutely, like, my husband's military, and we might be moving. We might not. I mean, it's kind of up in the air. And the reality is, like, I don't want to leave, but at the same time, like, I'm not afraid. You know, I've moved before, and I know that as long as I throw myself into AA wherever I go, like, I'm fine. And I don't know. I hope somebody got something out of that. If you didn't, I'm not a spokesperson for AA. There's tons of people with tons of experience. The first guy I ever related to was a biker. You know, and you couldn't have told me when I sat down at that meeting and he stood up to speak that I relate to him. But I totally related to him. And so if you're new, keep coming back and hang out and come out to eat with us after the meeting. Thanks.